Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today are two of my colleagues from SMA News Today, Michael Morale and Deanne Runge. It's been a minute since we've all done one of these. So, Michael, Deanne, really great to have you back.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. Happy. I know I don't know when the rule is for when you can stop saying Happy New Year, but I'll go ahead and say it since the first time all three of us are back recording. So Happy New Year. This will be your first like more roundtable of 2022. So I'm really excited. And today we have a really special topic for all of you listeners. This is something that we talk about a lot in the SMA community, and we have done podcast episodes on this before, but it is the subject of caregiving and specifically hiring and managing caregivers. And I know that it's always a prominent discussion in SMA forums and Facebook groups. So we, me, Michael, and Deanne all have very different living and caregiving situations. So we just kind of wanted to do a panel on that and share our experiences. Hopefully you'll be able to get some tips and just encouragement out of this, as I'm sure many in the SMA community are always struggling to find caregivers and don't know where to start. So we hope to give you some good information and perspectives on this subject. We'll also be talking about a couple columns, and there's not too much news to discuss right now, but you know, we'll catch up. So before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast was brought to you by Genentech, the makers of an FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
Okay, well, to start off, I did want to touch on a couple columns real quick. And so the first one is by Sherry Toe. This was written, or it was published at the beginning of January, and it hits on kind of her New Year's resolutions, and she titled it "Don't Wait Till for the Miracle to Happen." Basically, she's talking about how New Year's resolutions have changed for her over the years, and how, you know, health and circumstances can get in the way of what you initially set out to do. And so, I'll read just this excerpt from the column, which is about midway through. And she says, "All of these good things ahead don't mean I'm not weary or worried. My health could disrupt my plans. Disease-modifying therapies for SMA are still unavailable here in Singapore. One of my caregivers is leaving, and my family is looking for someone to fill her shoes. The COVID-19 pandemic remains a threat. Many other bad things could happen. To ease my mind, I've been repeating a line from Netflix's One Day at a Time: don't quit before the miracle happens." So this one I just really enjoyed. I liked how it touched on the notion of New Year's resolutions, but how particularly for those of us in the SMA community that, like Sherry says, they can change depending on circumstances and health. And it's important to look for the positives and set goals, but also understand to not put too much pressure on yourself. And so I thought this was a really cool column. And she also talks about and includes in the column a playlist that she created for this year that actually inspired me to do one of my own. So this was really a good column. I don't know, Deanne, Michael, do you have any other thoughts on this or things you want to point out?
Are you becoming a Swiftie?
I am.
Taylor Swift.
I am. I actually, so Sherry writes a lot about Taylor Swift in her columns. And I unabashedly told Alyssa, our co-moderator on the SMA forums and columnist, that I did become a Swiftie around November, December when she dropped that new album and I saw her performance on SNL. So I'm unabashedly a fan now. And it's I think her music is really cool. And it's cool how Sherry incorporates like themes from her songs into her columns. So I really like that.
Yeah.
But yeah. But
yeah, and then there was one quote I liked it when she was touched on scraping a columnist and refers to that episode of One Day at a Time, and then she reminds herself to remember how far she's come, but yet also how far she has yet to go. And that kind of motivates her too. And that's the don't quit before miracles happen. So yeah, I thought that was pretty.
Absolutely. It was a really nice touch. And you could tell there was a lot of personal sentiments in this column, and it was like both realistic and also still very, pushing for sky is the limit kind of themes. So there's a lot of really cool themes embedded into this column. And I just like how she touches on the whole concept of New Year's resolutions and how it might differ for people in our community. So yeah, I really love this one. Michael, I don't know if you had any thoughts too on this piece. But.
Yeah, I guess I'm the lone person out on this because I don't make New Year's resolutions. You know, I used to when I was younger, but I'm 56 years old and I don't think I've kept not one single New Year's resolution that I made. You know, you can make resolutions like, you know, I'm going to be a better person this year than I was last year. Well, if I said that, was I an evil monster last year? No. How much better could I be? I have no idea. But you guys may be Swifties. I'm not into that kind of music. I was raised with country and Western. And, you know, they say that if you play rock and roll backwards, you can hear the devil. But if you play country and Western backwards, the dog comes back, the wife comes back, and everything turns out great. So I try not to make New Year's resolutions because it's just something that I know that I'm not going to keep. You know, I'm going to be the best person that I can be. And whether or not it's better than last year, I have no idea.
Sure. No, I think that's a great mentality. And really, like, it's similar to me. I don't know if I was ever super intentional about making a bunch of resolutions, but I would try to go into the new year with a new mindset and, you know, be like kind of general things I wanted to do, you know, write more or do this, yeah. Do that. But yeah, but like I found that too, that it helps to, instead of like saying a resolution like, oh, I'm going to read for an hour every day or write for an hour a day or whatever it may be, exercise, like instead of doing those like daily things, sometimes it works great for people, but like Michael said, I think a lot of times it's easy to fall off on those and not commit. And so I think for me, it's better to set general things of what I wanted to either accomplish personally, professionally, whatever it may be, and kind of stick with that. But yeah.
Yeah, that's me too. I kind of go for the more general goals because like Sherry said, sometimes life gets in the way. And
sure. Indeed, it does.
To change course a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I will link both of these columns in the episode description. And the other one I wanted to touch on was a really great one written by Halsey Blocker, who I had her and her mom on the last episode of the podcast of 2021. It was a really great discussion if you haven't gotten the chance to listen to it. But Halsey wrote this piece about speaking to the next generation of people with SMA and how, you know, the face of SMA is changing. And she brings up this story about meeting a kid with SMA in Disney World. And it was not at an SMA conference. This was just happenstance. And so she talks about that and how, you know, with treatments and modifications and, you know, how many things in the world of SMA are changing every day, SMA is going to look very different. You know, it already is now than, you know, when me, Deanne, Michael were all kids, but even more so in the coming years as more treatments develop and, you know, what SMA entails. And so she gives a really good perspective on her thoughts on that and how it's still a matter of community, no matter what, you know, the disease, the disability may look like in the future, we all still have this connection. And so I'll share this one excerpt. This is also about midway through, or maybe a little earlier, but she says, the face of SMA is changing and our community's culture is changing with it. I sometimes wonder how the lessened effects of SMA will shape this new generation that is growing up in an environment that's so different from the one my generation grew up in. So again, I just really like this piece a lot. And I think it speaks to a lot of the mindsets of adults with SMA in particular. So I don't know, Michael, Deanne, if you had any other thoughts on this piece.
Yeah, I did. I know that it was a great piece. I did read it. And I think the thing is, people growing up in today's generation will know more about SMA because it is there. You know, it is a clinically diagnosable disease. Back when I was growing up, nobody knew what SMA was. Uh-huh. You know, the SMA gene was isolated in the mid-90s. And that's when they found out, because I remember getting a call from a hospital called Zell Lipschitz in 1990, I think it was 1998. And they had my medical records and they called me at work. And they said that by all the markers that I had and everything that my disease was showing, they thought I may have something called SMA. And that was a complete shock to me because I didn't know what SMA was. So I went in for a blood test, and about a week later, they called me and they said, yes, you got SMA type 3. So that's the first that I had heard of it. You know, I was first diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. Then I was diagnosed with myotonia congenita, which is similar to muscular dystrophy. And so that's what I lived with until the mid-90s. And I wasn't really clinically diagnosed until, I believe, around 1998. So my generation didn't really know what SMA was. You know, I went to the 2018 Cure SMA conference here in Dallas. That's where I met you, Kevin. And you and I had been working together for a couple of months, you know, before that. And I remember that was the very first time that I ever witnessed others that had the same disease that I did. And it was an amazing experience. It was very difficult. It was very cathartic for me because I saw people that were much worse off than me. And I started feeling better about myself, which sounds bad. You know, I don't want to make it sound like I was glad to see people that were worse than me, but I felt better knowing that I didn't have the level of disease that they had. But what I witnessed was when I went through the hotel and I saw all these children tied to tracheotomies and breathing machines, I didn't see anybody not smiling. Every one of these kids were smiling and they were having a great time. And I thought to myself, how dare I feel bad or better about myself when seeing all these other kids that were going to be much worse off than me when they got my age. So it was very eye-opening to me to be around other people with SMA. So my generation didn't have the luxury of knowing what we had until later in life. Today's generation, with the advancements of, you know, Spinraza, Zolgensma, Evrysdi, and hopefully by the end of this year, the first part of next year, they'll have a muscle-targeted therapy called apitegromab by Scholar Rock. So there's a lot more advancements in technology, treatable or treatments that are set up for people with SMA. I think their life is going to be much, much better.
No, and you bring up a good point about there's a lot of adults too, that like you, who didn't know what SMA was and didn't have a name for their disability. And so the not just treatments, but the amount of information and community resources have expanded rapidly in the past, especially 20 years. I mean, when I was born in the 90s, was diagnosed then. And so I would, like, my family and I were early involved in what was then Families of SMA before it became Cure SMA. And so we had those community resources, and then it changed even more with like social media and resources like that. And so, yeah, that is, you know, another element.
Even now, they diagnose at birth. So you can have the treatments from the very start. And I think part of what Halsey was saying too, is that because the landscape has changed so much, we have to look back at our experiences. I'm not sure you hear me very good today.
you're coming through now.
We have to look back at. Okay, we have to our experiences and share our experiences because the landscape is changing so much. So to keep that perspective.
Exactly. And absolutely. That's exactly what I was trying to say is that, you know, when these kids are being born now, and since a lot of states are now testing this at birth, is that they're diagnosing these infants with SMA and they can immediately get started on a treatment. Okay. So a lot of these children, hopefully, you know, will never know what a wheelchair is. And that's something that we can say now because there's so many treatments out there. You know, we've got gene modifying therapies and we've got a gene replacement therapy with Zolgensma. So they're now addressing this issue at a very, very early state in the child's life. And they're not going to have to go through what we went through as adults with regards to a lot of the atrophy, a lot of the muscle wasting, because if they get on these treatments early, it's much easier for them to adapt and to get maybe get stronger than what we went through when we first started on it.
Yeah, it's wild to think about. I mean, I've been going to conferences for years and just to see, again, how the landscape is changing. And so I really like how Halsey's touched on all of that. But ultimately looking at how, regardless of how the face of SMA itself changes, the community is what unites us. And so it's really cool. But yeah, I highly recommend listeners go back and read this column. Again, I'll link both of these in the description. But yeah, so I just wanted to touch on those two briefly. And before we get to our main event, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA, or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A treatment has been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this treatment option a reality. To learn more about this treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
Okay. Well, Michael, Deanne, thanks again for being here today. And now we move on to the main portion of this episode, which is, again, a discussion about hiring and managing caregivers. And so all three of us, again, have different experiences in this regard, different living situations. So for those who don't know, in my case, I live with my parents and I have caregivers come to my house. And if you follow my column, you know that I had the same caregiver for 7 years and he actually left back in October to start a new career. So obviously a big transition for me. He was my primary caregiver for a long time, along with several other people. So now I'm in the process of hiring new people while my parents are my primary caregivers in the meantime. And I've hired one so far and I'm, you know, slowly working my way up to building a team there. But Michael, Deanne, you both have different experiences in there. Deanne, why don't you start? Tell us a little bit about your living situation and what you do for caregivers.
I do live independently. So I live in a house on my own. And then I have caregivers that come in to help me periodically throughout the day. I have someone that stays overnight, and then I have someone that comes in for a couple hours during. I go through an agency, but they're very hands-off. So I have to select who I want to be my caregivers. I do the training and do this, which take care of the paperwork aspect of it. So that's what I'm doing now for caregivers.
Great, great. And then Michael, what about you? I know you also have a different living and caregiving situation. So if you want to talk about that.
Sure. I started looking for a caregiver. It wasn't too long after my mother passed away in 2008. my father started showing early signs of Alzheimer's, or I'm sorry, early signs of Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that, you know, my father, after my mother passed away, my father was my primary caregiver, but it was getting more difficult for him to do the things for not only himself, but for me. So we started looking at hiring someone to live with us on, you know, a 24/7, 365 basis. And so we advertised and, you know, we did Craigslist, we did care.com, and I ended up finding a caregiver that stayed with us. Our first caregiver stayed with us for probably about 6 months, and then she started getting sick. So we've gone through, you know, numerous caregivers over the time. Currently, I hired a young lady about 8 years ago, and she stayed with me and my father. She's still with me today, but she was also there when my father was alive. And then to make it easier for her, her parents moved in with us. So now it's her mother and father along with Jennifer. And then, so that way it's kind of a break. Jennifer doesn't have to do everything. Her father and her mother help out. And they've been with me for well over 8 years now. And so far everything is great.
That's great. That's great. And Michael, prior to, you know, when you hired that first one in 2008, had you done any other, had any other paid caregivers prior to that in your life, or was that your first experience with paid caregivers?
That was my first experience.
That's okay. Yeah. So, because I know, and this is something I think that, you know, everyone in the SMA community is different in terms of like some use government programs, some pay out of pocket, some wait till a certain time in their lives. So that's the thing I was curious about. And Deanne, for you as well, when was the first time you started hiring paid caregivers? And was it through a government program? Was it paying out of pocket? These are the things I think people want to know.
The first time I had an outside caregiver was when my mom had a back injury, like when I was in high school. And we contacted the county and they were able to send someone out. So that was kind of my first experience with an outside caregiver. And of course it was awkward and I hated it. And it took so much time and everything, but I'm glad that it worked out that way, because when I went to college, I had to totally rely on outside caregivers. I went through an agency and it was through a county program. My income is low enough where I qualify for Medicaid. So my PCAs are paid through Medicaid. And I'm limited with the amount of hours I can have for caregiving, which is somewhat restricting. When I decided to move into a house, the county said that you can't be alone overnight. And so I'm like, well, if I can't be alone overnight, you have to allow me to have someone overnight and through the day. So it was a little bit of a fight to get the hours that I needed, but it did work out based on I'd have someone overnight and then come in during the day.
It's a really good point about deciding the schedule that works for you. And also, you know, if you're working with the government program, this is something for people out there to be aware of. Like, the tricky thing is that it's very, in the US, it's very different in each state as far as like what the Medicaid and SSI rules are, how many hours they allow you, et cetera. That's one of the, and Deanne, you also brought up the kind of awkwardness of that first time you're hiring someone. And I will say that is a universal thing in this community and in other disability communities. It never really gets, I would say in my experience, it does, you do get a little more comfortable in the interview process. At least, again, this is just speaking from personal. I remember the first time I started hiring paid caregivers was in college. like Deanne, I was going through Medicaid. And so different agencies sent people for me to interview. It was the summer in between my sophomore and junior year. And for me, it was just a matter of my parents could still take care of me, but it was getting hard for them to do everything. And so I did want more independence, and I was considering possibly moving out or at least having some care at home. And so that was kind of what motivated me to look into it. And, my mom and I went through a bunch of loopholes to try to figure out who to talk to. And, but that initial experience of interviewing someone is always a very overwhelming, and it can be, you're just worried about everything because this is someone who is going to be doing things in a very intimate space. And, you know, if it was prior to that, whether it was your parents or family members or whoever who was doing your primary care up until that point, it's really hard transitioning to someone else. And so I just want to put that out there for our listeners that that is something that is very universal in the community. And so that leaves my...
And nobody does it. Nobody does it like your parents, you know, or whoever long time caregiver has been. So you always question, oh no, am I ever going to be comfortable again? But I assure you, you will.
And it was a similar anxiety for me too when Randy, my longtime caregiver, left a few months ago. It was, we also had that vibe too. And like, he knew my needs specifically. And so similar to me of like, oh, am I ever good? Yeah, that's a great point, Deanne, of like, am I ever gonna be comfortable again? It's something that looms over your mind, but I would say it'll take some work to find the right people, but it'll be worth it. You will find people who can, no caregiver is the same. I mean, you're gonna have a different flow and fluidity with each person, but yes, you can teach people how to perform the tasks you need and to meet your needs. So that leads to my next question. Like, Michael, I'll start with you. So especially because you were looking for a live-in caregiver at that time, can you talk about what the interview process was like, what questions you asked, and what you were looking for in that person?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I did my first round of interviews, back when I first hired someone, I really didn't know what to ask. I mean, a lot of it was a learning process that I had to go through. But, you know, the first time that we spoke, I got a different phone number and I created a different email address that was not my own personal email address, which I thought was a good idea. And it ended up being a very good idea because, you know, you're going to get people that are going to apply for this position, and they sound great at the very beginning. And then you find out that, you know, hey, these, you know, after doing a background check, you find out that some of these people had convictions on their record that you just don't want to bring them into your home. One lady tried to convince me that the attempted murder charge on her rap sheet was a mistake. Well, they're going to tell you what they want you to hear to try to convince you. But, you know, once I found out that she had that kind of conviction posted on her criminal record, it made me very thankful that I did a background check. But the one thing that you got to remember when you're hiring a caregiver is that you got to be very open. You got to be very honest with yourself. You know, questions like, are you going to need somebody to help you go to the bathroom? Are you going to need somebody to wipe you, you know, to get you clean? These are questions that may be embarrassing to talk about, but it's going to be part of their job. You know, we all go to the bathroom. You can't stop that. That's just part of life. So you're going to have to let them know exactly what you need, and you need to be honest with them. You know, you don't want them getting the position, and then the first day they said, wait a minute, I've got to wipe you to get you clean. That's not part of my job. Well, yeah, it is part of your job. And that's what we discussed. And so lay everything out on the table. Try to think of every single question that they're going to come up with. Let them know exactly what you or whoever you're hiring the caregiver for, let them know what they're going to be doing, because they need to know this information up front. Because the more honest you can be at the very beginning, it's going to eliminate a lot of the problems later when you do encounter a problem. So I learned after the first one that I should have asked more questions. I should have been a little bit more honest. And that was my fault. But like I said, it's a learn as you go type process. And each time that you hire a new caregiver, you update those questions with the ones that you should have asked before. So you're not going to find the right person the first time. There's no way of getting around that. As much as you think that you've laid out all the ground rules, you'll find something that you missed. I'm done.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it's a great point about being thorough and communicating exactly what your needs are. And also, that was what I was curious about too, Michael, with you having live-in caregivers. I think you have to do an even extra level of security, because these are people who are not only be coming and, working shifts, but actually staying with you. And so you want to make sure you're extra cautious about the kind of people you're letting in and doing background checks, doing all of that. And so that's absolutely the case. And Deanne, for you as well, what are some of the main questions you ask? And I also want to ask too with this, is it important for you to find someone that you vibe with and that have kind of like a personality check, or are you just looking for someone who can adequately perform their job?
I think it's really important that you find someone that you can get along with. I've had interviews where it's just a stone sitting there and I get no reaction whatsoever. And I'm like, now I cannot spend hours with a person that has no personality whatsoever. But like Michael said, I really go into it explaining what I need and then seeing what their reaction is to that. Some people, if they've never seen caregiving before, I know it's going to be a lot more challenging to teach them. So I kind of look for people who have a bit of experience, as like maybe CNA experience, or I like finding tech students that are going for nursing. They might have might be short term because they have bigger career goals, but at least I have someone that I know figure it out a little quicker. It's tough for me. I don't have a set list of questions. I go into it. I like to know what their background is. Yeah. And then I kind of go from there. I usually in my posts, when I look for someone, I say CNA experience beneficial, but not required. That way they kind of know I'm kind of what I'm looking for.
I'm very similar to you in that regard, especially because the program I'm with now, I still use a government program, but it allows me to hire whoever I want. And so, Medicaid gives me a certain number of hours each week, but I do all the hiring. And I put a similar note of like, hey, if you have caregiving experience, great. But if you don't, that's not I'm more looking for people who can communicate well, who can, work with me. And the one I have right now is working out great. He had no caregiving experience prior to this, and he's working out really well. I mean, he's still in the medical sphere because he's a grad student who's working on a physiology degree and is going to go to med school eventually. So I knew like that was a really good quality to have. But also one of the things too, I put in my job ads is like, I put all of my needs and, give people up front a notice about what they're going to be doing. But also I try to put a lot of my own personality into it. And that's how, the caregiver I have now, he applied because I said I was a Star Wars fan in my ad. So, you know, and put a picture of myself. And so, Deanne, like you were saying, of that personality mesh, I think it is important. I mean, not that you can't have caregivers that, I mean, especially if they're only doing, you know, smaller shifts, and like, as long as you get along well, they don't have to be your best friend, but some definitely will be. I think, you know, one of the things that agencies told me when I first started this process back in college was that to not become friends with your caregivers, which I think is the worst advice ever, because I mean, you're spending time with someone in such an intimate space, and not, like I said, you're not going to be best friends with all of them, but I mean, Randy and I are total brothers, and I've written about him many times, met plenty of others who we formed a really close bond. And so for me, I think it's kind of inevitable to become friends with at least some of yours, or especially the ones that stick around the longest.
Well, and I'm sure with Michael's situation, having a caregiver, you know, obviously have become form a friendship. I've had so many caregivers come and go. Mm-hmm. I do have a bit of a wall where you don't want to become personally invested because they might leave next month. So I think because I do want a friendship, but I don't want to put myself in a vulnerable where I can get hurt, or I don't know if that makes sense at all. But
no, I know exactly what you mean. It's almost a matter of like codependency. Like if you become so attached to one person, but and you know, believing that they might stay around forever, it's really hard to accept the reality when they do have to, you know, they do go for a new job or new career, whatever it may be. And so, no, I totally understand what you're saying there. It's one of the toughest things. It's like, yeah.
I keep it in the back of my mind that this is a job for them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can be friends and you can have friendly conversation and have fun doing stuff, but it is a job too. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's great if you have those lasting relationships, because I mean, even like, you know, Randy's been gone for a few months with me, but we still keep in touch regularly. I saw him over Christmas, and, you know, we have that bond. And I also have, it's Dan, actually, it's funny what you said earlier about, you know, if it's a red flag, if someone is just kind of like sitting there during an interview and looks like, you know, really zoned out or whatever. Ironically, there was one guy I had around the same time as when Randy started, who when I their first interview, I was like, I don't know, this guy's like really not giving me much, and seemed just kind of like non-talkative. And then he became one of my closest like caregivers. He only worked with me for a year before he left for the military, but then he actually, him and his girlfriend moved back here a few months ago. And so it was a really funny instance of, I didn't think there was much there in the like first impression. And then we became like super close. He was just like more introverted than me. But so it's just funny. And there are situations like that.
You have to just give it a shot, you know, to just see if it works.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this leads to the next question. Now, this, feel free to share as much or as little as you feel comfortable with, but you know, conflicts with caregivers are going to happen. It's inevitable, especially when you're in a close space like that. It happens, and there's, you know, that's something that we all deal with. So my question is, how do each of you deal with conflicts with caregivers when they arise?
Well, I think you have to understand conflict's going to happen with anybody that you live with. You know, you're not always going to see eye to eye with everything that they want to do versus what you want to do. And there are going to be differences. And I think as long as you don't yell at each other, that you agree to disagree, and that you discuss it in a calm, rational voice. You know, there have been times that my caregivers have not wanted to do something in particular, and we talked about it, and you know, I'll try to be as accommodating as I can, But then again, they have to be accommodating to my needs. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why they live with me. And so, you know, I've never gotten to the point to where I've had to terminate someone based on their inability to do something that I feel like I need. It's come close a couple of times, but we always find a way to work it out. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to give in and say, okay, I agree with you. But then again, sometimes they agree with me that, okay, look, maybe we need to be doing this, even though it's not really what they want to do, but they know it's in my best interest. So just know that you're not always going to see eye to eye. You know, there are going to be disagreements, but as long as you remain calm and that you know that, you know, you need to be able to express your feelings without fear of them saying, well, that's a stupid idea. You know, and then again, you have to remember that when they express a concern to you, you need to listen to them and try to take into account what they're going through as well.
So, it's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be my advice.
That's great. And Deanne, what about you? And you can all, I know Michael brought up too, that it, like, this happens too. I mean, you have to can't let caregivers go sometimes, especially when you have a lot and you're going through it. So kind of a double question for you, Deanne, of like, again, what do you do to manage conflicts? And also, when do you know when it's time to cut someone loose?
I've only had one caregiver that left on maybe not so great terms. We just didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. And it was time to go. So it was kind of a mutual decision that, yes, it was time to go. But a lot of my that I have currently, we have very opposite political views, but we share our opinions, but we don't force it on either one of us. It's kind of good to have that open discussion without being very forceful about it. And we just agree to disagree on a lot of things. And so right now that's working for me. And if there is something that comes up that, you know, isn't working out, then I just bring it up to them, and it's either they, you know, make an effort to change or we part ways. But I think you have to kind of yourself a little bit and understand where they're coming from too. So if you understand where they're coming from, you can maybe with it a little bit and figure out the best solutions. So I guess that would be
my advice. Hey, I say the philosophy of Ron Burgundy comes into play a lot in our lives of agree to disagree. So, that is a really great point. I mean, I would say in my case, like, there's only been a couple times, I think, like, I've left on not so great terms. And it's just a matter of like, yeah, you know, when it's like, I don't think I've ever actually like fired anyone, but like some, you know, they had conflicts with like the agency I used to be with. There are a number of factors that come into play. It's really great advice to you is like, you know, when something is going to work out and you can resolve it, and when it just isn't, and that's okay. And it doesn't make like you or the other person bad or wrong. It just means like, it's, you're not always going to vibe, and that's okay. So about finding who will be the right person and eventually who won't. But I think it is a good chance of, like Deanne, like you said, of like, sometimes giving it a shot is really good, as long as they're not, you know, like, I mean, horrible or like, you know, it's gonna be a really bad situation. If it's not like, you know, super clicking right away, but you know, you need someone and you want to give them a shot, I think that is a good approach, honestly, because you never know what might work out eventually. And so
I think that it's really important to learn how CA works. Everyone has a different style. Mm-hmm. And so if you can tap into what their strong suit is, it makes life a lot easier. Some people are more visual learners, so they need someone to show them how to do it. Some people like to be talked through it. So just kind of figure out their learning style and how it works. I think that helps too, as far as getting comfortable with the caregiver.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point too, of like, whether it's your parents or someone you live with or whatever, to kind of show the person initially. Like you said, some people, they just catch on really quick, but in other situations, like, that's where I like living with my parents. And if a new caregiver comes in and they need just a little bit of explanation on how to do something, you know, my mom or dad can show them how, and that is really beneficial. So yeah, that's a great point. And then one scenario, and this is something I'm curious for both of you too, and this is tricky, I know, especially when you're living independently, but if something comes up with a caregiver and they're not available, do you have other people in your life who can kind of help you out in these scenarios? Michael, we'll start with you, because I'm curious in this scenario of, like, I know you have three living caregivers, but still, like, in situation, we've talked about this, but like, in situations, if they're out of town, let's say, or something like that, do you have kind of a backup plan?
Yes, I do. Jennifer and her parents usually go on vacation with the other part of their family toward the end of August, 1st of September. And so they're gone for about a week. So I have another caregiver that I've used in the past, and she always comes over and she'll spend time with me and help take care of me while they're on vacation. You know, your caregivers need a break. Yeah, they can't stay with you every single day, every single hour. You know, they need a break, just like, you know, everyone else. You know, everybody gets a vacation if they have a job, and that vacation is used for them to enjoy themselves and to be away from work. And so it's good for Jennifer and her parents to be able to get out of the house and get away from me, you know. And so I do have another caregiver, and she's been working with me for the past couple of years, and she's great. I give her a call maybe a couple of months before they go on vacation, and she puts me on her schedule. And so, you know, she doesn't have to stay with me during the day as much, if she has other clients, but she's always here to get me up in the morning, get my lunch, and then come back around bedtime, and she'll stay with me overnight as well. So, you know, we do have a really good situation that seems to be working out, you know, very well.
That's great. That's great. And Deanne, what about you too? So, you know, especially if, like, as this happens too, unfortunately, if like a caregiver calls out last minute, you know, do you have kind of a backup plan in those situations?
Yeah, I've had to deal with this quite often, and it can be a struggle. Usually I kind of have a text chain with my other PCAs. Uh-huh. I put a couple calls out to a couple other of the PCAs to see if they can fill in. And usually one or the other will say, yeah, I can do it. When in doubt, my mom's reliable backup. I try not to rely on her too much, but it happens where all mom. Then if I'm in real dire straits, I could call my sister. She could, but I try not to do that. Well, I don't think I have done that. I have, there has been occasions where if I can get by without someone being here, I have done that before too. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not, you have to.
No, absolutely. And I think especially in the pandemic age, like, it's even more of an issue, and it's something that it's really hard. And I bring up this question more just to provide empathy to people out there, because I know all of us have probably been in this situation. And so it is really hard. And I just wanted you to know you're not alone. But I think for me too, one of the things I do is that, you know, I have a lot of friends in the area who, if they may not do like heavy caregiving stuff, like lifting me, bathroom, et cetera, but I kind of have a running joke that if you become close friends with me long enough, you'll probably know how to empty my catheter at a certain point, because like I have, you know, to give like my parents a break and stuff like that when I'm out with friends, like, you know, because I need help with everything from, I mean, my robotic arm gives me a lot of independence, but even then just like getting rides, you know, having someone with me during the day. So I have especially like a core group of really close friends who are willing to help me out anytime. And like, and you know, and of course that changes too. I mean, we're all in our, I'm 28, you know, a lot of my friends are 20s and 30s. And so, you know, jobs and stuff and circumstances change, but nonetheless, like they're all really willing to help me out. And so if I need a ride to an appointment to give my mom a break or something like that, you know, I have those people that are not paid caregivers, but good friends that I can depend on as well. And I'll do things in return too. Like my kind of like usually standard is if someone drives me to an appointment, I buy them lunch or whatever. So having that kind of network is really helpful too.
Yeah, I have a great network of neighbors. So if something does come up, I can call a neighbor. One time my back door didn't work, so my dog was stuck outside barking, and the neighbor came, knocked on my door, is everything okay? And I said, oh, good, can you let my dog in the house? You know, so it's nice that you can have, if you can have a network of friends and neighbors that are willing to help out with the little things, that everything doesn't get in person all the time.
The little things make such a difference. It's just, it's really bad. And even, I mean, I have a 5-year-old niece and then 2 younger nephews, but my niece is at the age where she can start helping me out with little things like handing me a cup or whatever when she's back hanging out at my room or whatever. So things like that. I also, you know, my cousin, when he's in town, he drives me around, stuff like that. So it's good to have that kind of network as well. Knowing that you don't have to rely entirely on paid caregivers. You can have, you know, loved ones, friends in your life that find those people who will support you when you need. So, well, guys, this has been a fantastic session. And just wrapping up here, you know, this, I you know, I know we've touched on a lot of kind of advice here, but what advice or message do you have for others in the SMA community who A, might be struggling to find caregivers, or they may have no idea where to start?
I think for me, you have to understand that finding a caregiver, whether it's going to be, you know, a funded caregiver by the state, or if you're going to have to pay for them out of pocket, it's not an easy process. Mm-hmm. You can't just twitch your nose and find a caregiver. So building up a network of people that you've used in the past that are willing to come back and help you in a time of need, or talking to the state about maybe, well, what they can do to help you find a caregiver. I think the one thing that I need to stress is security. Yeah. If you're bringing someone into your home to take care of you or a loved one with SMA or whatever disease or ailment that they may have, you have to understand that you've got to run background checks. And that's got to be normal. And if anybody hesitates on giving you the information, like, you're going to need to get their social security number to run a background check. And don't just run a statewide check, run a nationwide check. They may have not done anything. Like, I live in Texas. If I just did a state background check, I'm only going to see if they've done anything illegal in the state of Texas. But a nationwide check will check all 50 states. Mm-hmm. And that's what you need to do. And if they're hesitant in giving you the information that you need to run this background check, scratch them off your list and move on. I mean, don't go, well, okay, I like you and I think I can trust you. No, don't trust anyone. And I hate saying that because I'm a very trusting person. But when you're bringing someone into your home, you don't know what they've done in the past. And so that's why I would say, make sure that you run a nationwide background check. You can search on the internet and find companies that'll do it. It normally costs about, you know, $90 to $100 to do it, but it's money well spent. So just know that you're not always going to find the right person the first time. You're probably going to go through numerous caregivers, but don't give up. Stay strong to your convictions and just know that you're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. No, and I was about to say, going back to our comment about like giving people a chance, absolutely. But also, like Michael said, if they're refusing to give background information, that is a huge red flag. Do not pursue it further. So that's great. But Deanne, what about you? Just any advice for people who are just starting out or struggling?
I think maybe the best thing to do is contact your county. They can kind of tell you what programs you're eligible for and what you're not, and kind of do a little bit of guidance on where to go. And then always find what works for you, find what's best for you. It is a process and it isn't always easy, but you can.
Definitely. And I would say, to add to that too, I would just say, stay connected with the SMA community. If anyone knows what you're going through, it's us. And so, you know, there are myriad ways, you know, Facebook groups and forums. And so don't ever hesitate to reach out to people. You know, our community would love to help you out. There are a number of other SMA groups and disability ones as well. So just stay, you know, encouraged and like, but also, you know, feel free to vent as well. We're all in this together. And, you know, it's never an easy process. And there are many loopholes and steps to go through, but it'll be worth it if you just kind of, you know, keep looking. You will find the right people eventually. Well, Deanne, Michael, this has been a fantastic conversation. I want to thank you both for coming on today. And, you know, listeners out there can find both of you on our YouTube channel and our forums. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and follow our main website at smanewstoday.com for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care, everyone.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.